The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton. John is the president of Etherton Associates and a frequent guest on the show and an important guest, one of my key go-to guys, especially when you start talking about procurement policy, current legislation on the Hill. We'll be talking today a lot about the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, and the acquisition provisions therein. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's great to be back.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. And I think one of the things we agreed to before we started the show, right, this is how this works, folks, is let's talk contract duplication first. For those of you who are familiar with John was a member of the SARA panel. He worked on the Hill for 18 years. One of his focuses when he was on the SARA panel back in 2007 was the Interagency Contracting Working Group. And we focused a lot on contract duplication and developing sort of a framework for trying to vet contract vehicles, whether they're enterprise contract vehicle, enterprise across agencies, big IDIQs. And John, we made some recommendations, and where did it go from there?
Well, I think that our focus at the time, we had a couple of issues that we had to reconcile in looking at this. One was that we wanted to provide contracting officers with some different options for buying different types of things, not just limit them to one contract vehicle or force them to do an individual contract when there would be other opportunities out there that could be time savers and really things that would streamline the process. So we were sort of in a little bit of a dilemma. So how do you come up with a mix of options that, on the one hand, provides different ways of buying a particular supply or service, and on the other hand, not have so many vehicles that folks on both the government side have to spend a lot of time in unnecessary administration, and companies then spend a lot of time trying to chase business on all sorts of different vehicles, when in fact there's only so much business that's flowing through the system. So what we did was we came up with a proposal which would essentially have a requirement that the agencies develop a business case analysis and that the vehicles not be permanent, that there would be sort of criteria for the creation, that they would be monitored, and then the vehicles, after a certain time that they've outlived their usefulness, they would go away, and there would be sort of an oversight of this process from the Office of Federal Procurement Policy. But we didn't put the Office of Federal Procurement Policy in a position where they would simply say yay or nay when agencies decided to create the vehicles.
More an advisory role or something? Did you ask the right questions?
Some requirement that there be governance of the business case formation process and that there be appropriate review so that the valid need for the vehicles could be reestablished if, in fact, there was some discussion of continuing them. But we said in the report that if this process doesn't work, the next step that should be considered is some group, whether it's OFPP or the folks at OMB or someplace on a government-wide basis, ought to actually dictate whether certain vehicles can be created or not be created, that there be some final court that would make those decisions. And I think as I look at the attempts to try to implement what we recommended through the memo that Dan Gordon put out a few years ago when he was OFPP administrator, and some of the other efforts, that perhaps that next step is something that we ought to look at, because it does seem like that there is now this still issue of proliferation of vehicles while we're not proliferating the dollars that flow through them. So,
right. Like a bunch of silos, but right. Like,
yes.
You know,
ever narrower. That companies spend valuable bid and proposal costs chasing business through. And so I think that's probably a point where we are now, so that I think people need to look at. It'd be interesting to see, sort of where all that goes. I do think, though, in looking at this, one of the issues that we need to talk about are the root cause analysis. Why do agencies are they so eager to create these vehicles, especially ones, you know, for internal purposes primarily. And I think one of the areas that we seriously need to look at is the lack of, oftentimes, the agency's perceived lack of intelligence about where their folks are spending money on some of these vehicles as a justification for creating their own, which in their view have the benefits of these, you know, larger buys, you know, volume, terms and conditions, that sort of thing. But at the same time, give them more insight into where their dollars were actually going. If that's really an issue that still needs to be addressed, maybe that's the first thing that we need to be looking at, rather than saying that, you know, there's some boundaries around creation of new vehicles.
Yeah, and to your point, it should be just as easy to place an order and track the funds on a GSA schedule or a NASA SUP or NIH contract vehicle as, you know, placing order on your own organic vehicle. I mean, and if that's still an issue that's driving proliferation, that's, I mean, there's investments there in systems or whatever that, well, over the long term would save everybody a lot of money.
Right.
So my other question based on what you said is, and I'll go back to, you know, one of the things we did talk about on the panel, which is now 8 years ago, I acknowledge that, but the idea that maybe if this sort of business case analysis doesn't work, you know, maybe it's time for to a little bit more authority to say yes or no on some of these things. You know, I know there was a lot of thought about that, and just even you're interested in your thoughts now, because you get into the issue there as someone who worked at GSA, is like the old GSA exclusive procurement authority for IT and delegations of procurement authority, and an entire government infrastructure built around analyzing whether somebody should be able to do their own contract or not, and just the bureaucracy there. Is a devil you know or devil you don't know kind of thing.
I mean, and that's why I think we resisted going there initially, because honestly, we were, and I think we talked about this in the report itself, we were really focused on forcing the agencies themselves to accept the responsibility and be accountable for the decisions that they made. And as soon as you lift it to a higher level, then some of that accountability, you know, on people's part sort of gets diluted and goes away. And that's, to me, that would be an unfortunate outcome. But I think if that's the only way that you can effectively manage this, it may be something that we have to look at.
Right. Or maybe a middle ground is, you know, going back in and strengthening priorities for pre-existing in regulation so that it's, you have to actually do a lot more to create your own. I mean, it's kind of flipped. I mean, I know, for example, in the GSA schedules priority, you know, versus other contract vehicles has, you know, softened over time. Mm-hmm. And more to the point, you know, there's language now too about making determinations of if you use another contract vehicle, it's the best, you know, it's statutory language, which I think had good intentions, but unintended consequences. If you have to document why using, you know, a NASA SUP or NIH or GSA is the best procurement method to meet your needs, well, it's kind of much easier to do your own thing than have to try to explain that and go over that high bar.
Right. And I think that was, for example, the Navy approach when they set up Seaport E. What did they talk about it? It was a mandatory vehicle of choice.
Which mandatory. Yes, that's only the government kind of phrase, right?
Great phrase. But the idea being that this is where you will, you know, this is the vehicle that you will use. It doesn't preclude you from using these other vehicles, but again, the bar is pretty high in terms of making a case to do that.
So is that something in your crystal ball? Do you see next year somebody thinking about, do we put more teeth in, you know, that business case analysis requirement?
I have not heard anybody on the Hill talking about it very much. Frankly, one of the situations where I think it will become more of an issue is if we start taking a government-wide approach to acquisition transformation or acquisition reform rather than having it focused primarily on Title 10 and DOD. I think when the committees more broadly sort of get engaged in this process, I think that will really open up the opportunity to have that conversation.
Right. I think that's it's a bigger group, but more focused on cross-cutting issues as opposed to trying to do it through the NDAA, right? Well, John, we're already up on the break. We just got through contract duplication a little bit. My guest today is John Etherton. He is the president of Etherton & Associates. And when we come back, we'll start talking about the current state of commercial item acquisition in federal government, and maybe we can transition into the current Title 8 of the NDAA and what's all the interesting, fascinating acquisition provisions that are in there. And John will fill us all in. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we're talking acquisition policy per usual or on this show, but also we're going to talk with John about the NDAA acquisition provisions. But first, John, when we were talking the last segment about contract duplication and whether maybe perhaps it's time to at least examine the possibility of greater teeth in the business planning process, where somebody actually sort of has to say, well, that's a good idea or not, as opposed to the agency is doing it for themselves, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's always a good idea to do my own contract vehicle. And you talked about, well, maybe it needs to morph to be effective into a government-wide sort of effort looking at acquisition. But what triggers that? What gets people to, because, year in and year out, we see things being done in the NDAA. Sometimes they have government-wide application. Most of the time, their provisions focused obviously on the department. When does it sort of, or what are kind of the tipping point or events in your experience that sort of drives that?
Well, it's interesting to go back and look at what happened during the process that we had putting together the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act back in the early 90s. And the triggering event for that process in Congress was when the Section 800 panel came back with their recommendations, 1,800-page document, which sort of went through and made a number of recommendations on modifying and repealing and changing acquisition statutes across the government. That was originally a DOD-only effort. It was in the Defense Authorization Bill for fiscal 1991. And we talked to the 800 panel and several of us from the committees, not just Armed Services, and they ask us, what should be the scope of our review? Should we stick with Title 10? Should we look at, more broadly at all the statutes affecting acquisition? And we told them, look at everything. If you've got the resources, go ahead and take a look at and make recommendations across Title 41, Title 40, Title 10, Title 15, whatever. And so they did. And so when the report came back, we on the Senate side, at least on the Armed Services Committee, went to our counterparts on the Governmental Affairs Committee and said, this really now is a government-wide effort. We would like you to take the lead in this review. And so they sort of stepped up and took the lead on that. And we sort of had several committees involved. We had small business. We also had a little bit of Judiciary Committee, but it was primarily small business, governmental affairs, and armed services jointly. In fact, we even had joint hearings, which I haven't seen since. With those three committees, we had a series of them looking at the issues in the bill and in the legislation. I think it will take some triggering event like that, whether it's a legislative proposal or something that will draw in the other jurisdictions and the other committees to really make this more of a government-wide effort rather than a DOD effort.
Okay. I think one of the things that came out of FASA, right, and the panel was, some creation of commercial item contracting preferences and commercial item acquisition, Part 12 of the FAR, all those wonderful things. So I think it's a good segue to just ask you your thoughts on the current state of commercial item acquisition in the federal space. You can talk about where it is right now, and then perhaps some of the language, interesting language in the National Defense Authorization Act.
Okay, thanks, Roger. I think that this issue has evolved ever since we started down the road with the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act. The Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, and to some extent the Clinger-Cohen bill that came a year or two later, the Federal Acquisition Reform Act, we were looking at trying to open up the aperture so that it was much easier for the government agencies to buy commercial items or even items that were similar to commercial items for a number of different reasons, especially given the fact that in the electronics industry, for example, at the time, the private sector was really pushing the envelope. It was really coming more from the commercial side than it was from the department and many of the technologies. But we started out in the definition. If you read the definition of commercial item in the code, it's quite broad. Yeah, it covers a lot of things like of a type items, so-called, and items offered for sale. And there have been just, you know, continuing issues as to how you effectively have that very open, broad definition of commercial item and how you are, you know, you can, on a day-to-day basis, you know, with the government acquisition process, you can acquire these items and still, you know, work pricing and some of the other issues. And these were things that arose very early after the legislation was passed, and we still seem to be wrestling with them. Unfortunately, from my view, I think folks have tried to attack this issue by either trying to limit the broad definition of commercial items in ways that I think would actually cut off the agency's access to commercially developed technologies or solutions, or we've tried to take you know different approaches on the pricing side, which again really sort of limit the aperture effectively than what we had originally envisioned. So we're sort of in the midst of this right now. There was the rule that came out in August from the Department of Defense, the proposed rule on price reasonableness determinations, which has been somewhat controversial because of the very, I guess I would say, restrictive way it looks at pricing and what would be valid pricing strategies in terms of defining them in some detail as a process in the rule. And this was certainly an issue that was taken up by the committees, both House and Senate, in the language in the Defense Authorization Bill entitled Title 8. And so now we're in a situation where we've got sort of what I consider to be competing views of what, you know, appropriate approaches both on the commercial item determination side and on the commercial price reasonableness determination that I think we're going to have to reconcile over the next several months, as assuming that the bill eventually gets passed, that folks will have to take a look at that and reconcile that with some of the approaches that we're currently ongoing.
Yeah, so is it, I mean, it always strikes me as that it's, you know, the idea of the tying commercial item definition to the price, or fair and reasonable price determinations or analysis, and that's why some folks believe it should be narrowed, because it would be easier to get certain information if under the current statutory and regulatory construct, if it's, you know, if something's not a commercial item. Is that, it's a coupling or decoupling of the two things, right?
Fair
and reasonable price versus commercial item.
Well, and if you look at most of the U.S. code, those are two completely separate determinations. You have a determination that something is a commercial item, and then you have the separate price reasonableness determination. There was one place in the code in 10 U.S.C. 2379, and dealing with either major systems that were purchased as commercial items or subsystems or components thereof, where the price reasonableness determination was an integral part of determining whether something was a commercial item or not. The Armed Services Committees, both House and Senate, decided emphatically to separate out the two determinations. And we're having a different conversation, frankly, now on commercial item issues than we were a couple of years ago, at least as far as the Defense Department was concerned. I would say if you went back to the discussions in the 2011, 2012, even into 2013, the discussion was all around whether something could be determined to be a commercial item or not. And that seemed to be the main focus of the debate. Now I think we're focusing more on the price reasonableness determination process. People seem to be less troubled as to whether something is a commercial item or not. But the issue now is, you know, how do you determine reasonable price for items that do not have an established large private, you know, commercial market that's sold in substantial quantities to the general public? What do you do in cases like that? I think the department's rule takes a relatively narrow approach that will drive you pretty early in the process to get cost data, cost information, not certified cost or pricing data, but cost data as part of making it.
Isn't really about, it's not about, it's about not formally changing the definition,
right,
but creating processes that get you to the same point as right. if you did change the definition.
Right, right.
Is that fair?
Right. Yeah, I think that effectively by limiting or only creating clarity around certain options for pricing,
right,
then what you have is a situation where you're effectively limiting the definition.
Right.
In my opinion.
And using certain criteria about what those when right. those options kick in.
Right.
Like it's in terms of your, you know, the majority of sales to the private sector or not, or to the market, in
right,
the market.
Right.
No, that language has the effect of changing the definition.
Right. Right. Yeah, it effectively narrows the definition right. of what can be considered
yeah.
a commercial item, or what could be considered a transaction where you could apply commercial procedures.
To right. it. Well, John, we have to participate in some commerce right now and take our break. When we come back, my guest today is John Etherton. He's the president of Etherton & Associates. And when we come back, we'll look at some of those interesting provisions on commercial item acquisition in the NDAA, get John's take on those, and then we'll start going through, you know, all those acquisition provisions, at least the highlights mm-hmm. of what folks really need to focus on. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton. He's the president of Etherton Associates, and we're talking acquisition policy and the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2016. Conference reports out, all kinds of interesting provisions in here. And last segment, John, we were talking about commercial item acquisition, the state of play there. I know there's some interesting provisions in Title 8 of the NDAA dealing with commercial item and commercial pricing, that sort of thing. What are the highlights there?
Well, I think there are sort of, you look at two different areas. The first is the commercial item determination process. As I mentioned earlier, they changed the sections in 10 USC 2379, would change them to basically completely separate the commercial item determination process from the price reasonableness determination process throughout the code, so there would be no place or no items covered where one would be integral to the other. So that's one of the changes. Another change on the commercial item determination.
Well, what's the practical impact of that from a government perspective?
I think it will, from a government perspective,
Department of,
I think what it will do will clear up some confusion, because there are certain categories of items in current law for which you have to make a price reasonableness determination in order to justify a commercial item determination, and there are other items, the majority of items,
right.
where that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, and it only applies in the Department of Defense world. It doesn't apply to any of the other government agencies. So I think now there'll be some clarity around the fact that, in fact, in all cases, this is a separate determination. So I think that will help. On the a couple other areas on commercial item determinations, there is language in there that basically allows a contracting officer or sort of directs a contracting officer to presume that a prior commercial item determination was sound if it was made. There is a way to basically challenge that presumption and overturn it, but there, so that presumption is in there. Rather than having agencies have to justify a commercial item determination every single transaction where an item may occur, and I think that basically reflects what I have heard people on Capitol Hill say, which is if you read the statute carefully, in their view, once something is a commercial item, it's always a commercial item. It doesn't change based on its proportion of sales in the commercial marketplace or anything else.
Now, is that, that's clearly right in response to, you know, multiple determinations
right.
over and over again for each procurement as
right.
to whether a particular item is a commercial item or not.
Right.
Right. I mean, that doesn't sound like it makes a lot of, you know, process sense or
right.
business sense.
Well,
be careful with my words there.
Well, but I also think if you look in some of these things, there were different ideas that came out of the House bill and different ideas that came out in the Senate bill. And there was some attempt to sort of reconcile the two, but you'll see sort of a House flavor or a Senate flavor, depending on which provisions that you look at. The House had been very interested in creating some sort of a central commercial item determination capability with records kept of that, so that it would be something that could be searchable. In this case, in fact, the language even says that it would be publicly searchable. I don't know exactly how they do that. But so there are a number of changes there on that side. On the price reasonableness determination, if you read the language, There are several amendments to the Truth in Negotiation Act, which if you read it, really drive more alternative approaches on price analysis, a little more explicit language on that, sort of mandating consideration of even prior prices that were paid by the government in earlier cases as one source of information, although there's some flexibility as to whether, in fact, you have to use those in a decisive way or not. But there's very little discussion in there about sort of getting quickly to cost data and acquiring cost data as a way of justifying price. In fact, what I see in the bill is a number of steps before that even comes under consideration and sort of a mandated step-by-step process the contracting officers would be directed to follow in determining price reasonableness, which I think is in my view at least, is somewhat of a contrast to the proposed rule that came out from DOD in August.
Right, that you get to cost quicker.
Much more quickly.
So the policy goal with that change, with these changes with regard to, looking at pricing information, because even, you know, the FAR right now talks about prior prices paid, but, you know, as an element. Obviously, you got to look, you know, there's factors you have to consider, similar terms and conditions, time elapsed, that kind of stuff, but... Yeah, so is this sort of say, hey, we really want you to actually look at this as opposed to cost, or?
I think that is the message that I read from it. And there is also some more general messaging in there about market research and making that a more sort of emphatic kind of a process and really having the defense agencies at least look at commercial alternatives as requirements are put together, whatever, to really try to strengthen the preference for commercial items that, frankly, was put in place around the time of FASA. So I think there's sort of pretty clear signals that I read in this bill that that's the direction that the Congress wants the department to go.
Right. So I'm going to keep pulling on the string a little bit. So you know, the proposed rule out there that DOD issued on fair and reasonable pricing for a commercial item gets to cost quicker, no question. Is it an issue that they don't believe that there's good price information out there to determine fair and reasonable pricing, and that cost is cost, and it's easier to validate, or what is it? Because the other thing that's sort of an observation is, you know, although it's cost or pricing information, and it's uncertified because it's a commercial item, but give me a break. If you are submitting it to the government, you know, and the government's going to rely on it, you know, the fact that it's certified or not from a Civil False Claims Act perspective, I think, is irrelevant.
Right.
It's going to be, if the government relies on it and you submitted it and you got a contract result, if it's defective, it's defective. I don't care if the certification's there or not. I don't think the government would say the same thing I just said.
Right.
So, I mean, I know, is an issue of that they're just not a belief in price information or versus cost, or am I putting you on the spot there, John?
Well, no, you're not putting me on the spot. I think I've always felt, hearing especially from the oversight community in the department, mainly from the DOD IG, but others as well, there's some skepticism about the value of price analysis and how effective that can be in really establishing a reasonable price in order to justify something as a good deal for the taxpayer. What I see in the rule is a reflection of that view. That really there are only some relatively narrow kinds of approaches that seem to give you the, especially if you're looking at things on a transaction-by-transaction basis and looking at things sort of around individual transactions, that may be the only way, you know, strictly speaking, in some people's minds that you can get, you know, accurate information on whether you're paying a good price or not a good price.
Right.
So that's especially for items that might be not the commercially available off-the-shelf items or the things sold in substantial quantities to the general public type items, but the other type items are the offer for sale items. You know, again, there's no discussion other than in one part of the rule on the whole issue of commercial item determination, and it's only mentioned in passing in the subcontracting context. So I think this is a way for people to say, well, however these things feed into the system as a commercial item, here are some methods, the acceptable methods that are laid out in some detail for establishing reasonable price.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, that's a fair and reasonable discussion of this issue, huh? You like that one? Huh? Like that pun? I'm sure the listening audience does not care for it. So we can turn quickly. Got about a minute left in this segment, and then we'll spend the whole last segment talking about, you know, some highlights and where the process goes from here.
Okay.
But if you want one, you want to mention an additional, you know, NDAA provision, or is it another commercial item one that you wanted to mention?
I think that, you know, I've covered the commercial item ones in some detail. I think what was interesting to me was the approach on market research and the real emphasis on that as an upfront activity to really look for commercial alternatives for any new requirements that are coming out there. And I think
is that the idea of pushing openness to non-traditional,
I think that's
commercial
part
firms,
of,
innovation,
right,
the whole discussion these
right.
days?
I think that's part of it.
Yeah.
That there's much potential there that isn't currently being tapped in the process.
Right. Well, John, we do have to take our last break. You know, when we come back, I'm going to ask you about a couple of these provisions that sort of struck me, and then you can highlight the ones that you want to highlight, and then we can finish up just talking a little bit about the process moving forward. My guest today is John Etherton. He's the president of Etherton & Associates, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, the president of Etherton Associates, and we're talking acquisition policy and the National Defense Authorization Act for 2016. Conference report is out. Some very interesting provisions. And John, I'm going to ask you about one. I'm going to ask you about a couple, but you know, one that immediately struck me is, yeah, there's a provision there that would grant the Secretary of Defense the authority to waive acquisition laws to acquire vital national security capabilities. What that sounds like pretty powerful stuff right there in terms of being able to waive laws to get to a technology or capability that we need. Can you talk about what's going on there and what that provides?
Well, I think it's a pretty powerful tool if the Secretary of Defense chooses to use it. The only two categories of laws that are not eligible to be waived are those that impose criminal or civil penalties or sort of deal with the use of appropriated funds. So that's a...
Oh, your fiscal law stuff and your Civil False Claims Act stuff. Yeah, there you go. They got the things that covered. They needed money. That's all about money right there.
That's right. Everything else is fair game. I'll point out a couple things about that provision, though. Number one, it's non-delegable. So this is something that the Secretary of Defense, that he or she would have to basically do this themselves. It'd be a personal... There's a certification involved, I believe.
They have to report it to the Hill.
So, yeah. I would not expect to see widespread use of this authority or even, you know, at best it would be very limited use of authority. But the other thing that is also required in there is a lot of the requirements that they would be waiving. I think they're obliged to come back and say, well, we're not simply saying these are not important requirements, but we think there are better ways or maybe in a different time frame that we could do these things. So there are some limitations on that. What would be interesting, what will be interesting, assuming that this bill eventually becomes law, is to see, again, how often this gets used, what are the circumstances, and what does it tell us about sort of statutory requirements in general? Does this shed light into where some may or may not be useful or they may not be achieving their intended purpose or whatever? That's not a tactical provision. That one there is a pretty significant provision of law.
Right. It seems to me like I mean when you mention circumstances, I could say and we have another conflict.
Right.
Something happens. We need to get technology, or it's there's a cybersecurity incident or something that boom, you need to get something fast. I mean, there's already. You know, urgent and compelling circumstances and, you know, exception under CECA, but this seems to me is even more powerful and flexible.
Well, it covers that plus everything else. I mean, it really, it's really much broader in its effect.
Well, another one I'd ask you about that I know there's a lot of attention to is this sort of pushing oversight of major programs, systems, whatever, to the services.
Right.
What's that all about?
Well, I think that the original idea or the initiative for this came from the Senate, and I think it goes back to what Senator McCain has been very concerned about for years, and that is having greater accountability in the process. What he wants to see is individuals who have accountability for decisions, and I think the feeling on the committee was that by having the in statute the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics be sort of the default milestone decision authority for major programs, that somehow diluted that accountability that they were seeking. It also, you know, there are all sort of these stories that you hear about non-value added oversight and other kinds of activities that maybe emanated through that process that folks felt might be eliminated if they went and moved sort of the and again, it's a default. The Secretary of Defense can assign oversight for major defense acquisition programs to anybody in the Department of Defense, notwithstanding this language, but it sort of sets a presumption that the service acquisition executives would be the milestone decision authority for those programs. So you've got that. There are a couple things to say about it. Number one, it only applies to programs that enter Milestone A after October 1st of next year, okay. 2016. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that will have an immediate effect. There is some requirements on reporting on how this will all be set up. There's some interesting formulations in there. For example, it says that the Secretary of Defense is to ensure that only the absolute minimum, and those are the words in the statute, of requirements outside of the services process may be imposed from outside. I don't know what the standard for absolute minimum is. It'll be interesting to see how that all gets figured out.
We're talking about like further reviews by outside. Who knows what that means, right?
I think that'll have to be defined in the process and whatever system that they actually set up. Also, if the programs have a significant or critical cost growth breach under Nunn-McCurdy,
mm-hmm.
Then the secretary at any time can pull those out of the services and essentially assign them to some other organization in the Department of Defense. I do think there's a sense, at least for me personally, and I was involved in drafting the original legislation establishing the Undersecretary of Defense Operation for Acquisition as a result of the Packard Commission recommendations in the FY86 bill. I think there was some value in setting up that process.
You're an old guy there, John.
Yes, I know. Well, I started when I was 10 or 11 years old in the process. But I think that the issue there is that a deeper issue that no matter where you seem to assign the oversight responsibilities, where we do that, there seems to be a tendency for different organizations and oversight folks and other folks to sort of build up around some of those requirements. And I think that's more of a fundamental issue and a foundational issue that I think we need to look into, because I think that simply moving the assignment from the services to OSD or back doesn't really address that issue, which I think is really the fundamental.
Right. It's almost like I heard one of my friends says, painters have to paint. It's almost like, oversight has to do oversight, period, and just sort of mushrooms and crates.
But I think the way the conference addressed this should give everybody plenty of time to be able to look through all the implications of it and figure out, you know, how to do this well and figure out the other elements of it.
Sure. Another provision, and this gets, I think, you know, it's always the issue of intellectual property rights and technical data. I know there's some provisions in there. Mm-hmm. Quick thoughts on those, and then.
Well, we've got a provision dealing with a relatively narrow subset of issues on the presumption of whether something was developed at private expense or not. Folks who've been in the business for a while may recall that in the original legislation that we put together in 1995, we established a general presumption that any commercial item, even in the broad definition, was developed at private expense, and that it was the government's responsibility to rebut that if the government had information to the contrary. In the mid-2000s, that presumption was changed. Initially, the presumption was shifted entirely back, mm-hmm. so that the burden was totally on the contractor to show that an item was developed at private expense. And then there was a little bit of relief, I guess, or change, and so that commercially available off-the-shelf items, and any that the item or process around that was presumed to be developed at private expense, but anything in the broader definition beyond that was still, the presumption was that the government had paid for the development of the item. This language doesn't really change that to a significant degree, other than it allows for minor modifications or modifications of a type that were specifically intended to take a commercial item and make it applicable for a government customer. So it sort of expands that envelope a little bit, for the presumption.
Almost like if you customize something to
right,
the government.
Right, right. It opens that up. But I think that, more interestingly is this idea of creating a government industry sort of panel to review 10 U.S.C. 2320 and 10 U.S.C. 2321 in light of the way the world has changed since 1995 to see if there are any recommendations for change to deal with issues like the importance of software.
Absolutely.
Other, different architectures, that sort of thing, whether that needs to be reflected in a different way in the statute, and to look at it more in an integrated, holistic way than sort of the piecemeal changes that we've seen over the last 10 years.
So we got about a minute and a half left. So the process moving forward.
Well, the president
report.
Has said repeatedly he intends to veto the bill over the budget allocations or the transfer of the large $38 billion to the Overseas Contingency Operation Account as a way of avoiding the Budget Control Act caps and not providing additional funding on the non-defense agency side. And there's a couple other issues in the bill. So I believe that I fully expect the president to veto the bill perhaps as early as next week. I don't know what the Congress will do with that, if they'll make some attempt to try to override that veto. It appears that the votes are not there to do that, at least in the House of Representatives. And so I think everything will go quiet for a while. And then when we get the big deal, assuming we do, at the end of the year on these broader budget issues, that there will be a modified version of the authorization bill that will reflect that in the tables on the funding, and that the bill will pass largely as we've seen it come out of Congress. The bill needs to pass because there are authorities in Titles 5 and 6 for the troops that need to be renewed, mm-hmm. And somehow or another that needs to be done. So I think that will give the impetus for the bill to finally be done, and I think it'll be the entire package at the end of the day.
Okay. John, thanks. As always, great information. I really appreciate it. My guest today has been John Etherton. He is the president of Etherton & Associates, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Friday News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.